It's Petzl 30.
Wake
Petzl
up.
30. Wake up.
That's what my alarm says, Scott. Petzl 30. What the heck is Petzl 30?
Petzl 30 is any time you need to be on the trail where you need the advantage of an artificial sun
that you can strap on your head. So, Scott, you mentioned an interesting Facebook post.
Yes. We had a Nation member that got in touch with us and said, hey, thanks for letting me know about Petzl. I think in this case was a Tika RXP. He said he got one for Christmas and for trail running, and it works great. He said it's just wonderful out on the trail. But he also is a contractor and remodels bathrooms and kitchens, I think. And he said he started wearing it at work. And he said, you know, this isn't just for trail running. This thing can go from work onto the trail. In fact, he said he was going to possibly have it permanently attached
to his head. You mean like some people put tattoos on their face and yeah. implant different jewelry in their eyebrows in different areas?
Yeah.
We're talking implanting in their cranium.
Yeah, a pierced Tika RXP.
Now, Scott, that is an idea.
Well, what he discovered is what we've discovered, which many of the Trail Runner Nation people have discovered. The Tika RXP, the reactive lighting is freaking amazing. It adjusts to whether you're looking up, looking down the trail, and it beams out there, or whether you're looking down at the trail, and it does a nice, soft, wide panoramic light.
It's fun just to show people. I had somebody that was unaware of the technology altogether, a non-trail runner, and I just put my finger over that little sensor, and that light would get brighter, it would decrease, and it's just fun to show.
And it's rechargeable.
Lithium-ion batteries, they're light, they're bright, rechargeable many times, and I've stopped buying batteries at the store, Scott.
If you're running with anything other than a Petzl head torch, reconsider. You need to have an intervention and go to Petzl.com.
Are we recording?
Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Oh, come on. Don't put yourself down.
we are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
We're starting this off formally.
Yeah.
I'm Scott Warr.
And you, sir, are?
I am Warren Pohl.
And we thought, since Warren was on this podcast, we'd join a little bit early, catch up and see what's happening with Mr. Pohl. Because we haven't talked to him in a while, before we have our guest on, Jason, who has written an intriguing book. The title drew me in.
We'll reveal that later.
Yeah, Jason already knows the title.
I know Jason does.
Warren Pohl, what's happening?
Well, you know, it's cold and wet outside here in that London. And I think after a Forrest Gump moment after the UTMB last year, I'm rediscovering that running thing again.
Whoa, what, Forrest Gump? What, you got to explain what you mean by that.
Well, there's a bit in Forrest Gump where he goes for a long run and grows a beard and goes across the country, and I'm sure people have seen this, actually. Anyway, at one point he goes...
Do we have a bearded photo that we can...
I'm looking at Warren right now.
Is he bearded?
Yeah. Let me
I didn't know he was bearded.
Bring the screen over to you so you can see him. So, Warren, why don't you recap a little bit about that, of your race experience. What did you learn from that UTMB?
Well, it was... It was the strangest experience, but I'll keep it short for you. It culminates in this Forrest Gump moment, because what happened was that race has, as you know, motivated me for years. It's been my nemesis. It's been my goal. I've run there before, and I was going back, and that motivated me through an entire year of learning to run again as I went through rehab hell. It was all I thought about, and in the race itself, things didn't go entirely to plan. They went a bit south. The injuries did start playing up. I got myself through till about 8 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, I'm not going to finish this. But here's the weird bit. This is where the Forrest Gump bit came in. I just had this feeling like, I just want to stop running. It wasn't like a moment where you think, I'm out of motivation or I just need to dig deep. It was just, I think I need to stop running ultras for a little bit.
Mm.
And so, I was much... Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, so the scene in Forrest Gump where he has this big entourage behind him, and all of a sudden he just stops in the middle of nowhere. That's what you're talking about. Okay.
That's what I'm talking about. And as I'm stopped at the aid station and I'm really happy, you know, suddenly this gold has motivated me all these years, all this time. I said, I've done it before and I'm back. And no, it's just like it's gone. And so I very happily, they cut the tape from my wrist and I'm waiting for the bus to take me out of the aid station. It's about 8 o'clock in the morning. The weather is superb. The view is beautiful. I'm in a valley. There's mountains all around. And I see the scene with, I suppose you could say, sober eyes. There's a man pulling his trousers down to have a dump in a corner behind one of the tents. There's a runner who collapses catatonic like a fallen tree, still clutching her running poles in her hand and has to be revived by 5 medics at once. There's all the 1,000-yard stairs and all the wonder. And I just thought, it's time for a break. And so it was really weird going through that. And actually, if you'd have asked me about this in September, I don't think I'd have been able to make sense of it. But I just, after 7 years, I needed to stop that really big ultra focus. And having stepped away from it, what do you know? It just starts worming its way back in. You start running again for enjoyment rather than for goals. And somehow I've been talked into a 30-miler on Sunday. So maybe things haven't changed that much after all.
So have you been doing any running between the time that you Forrest Gumped, we'll add that as a verb, you Forrest Gumped.
Yeah. Post that, Scott.
And when you decided it finally wormed its way back, I mean, did you do any running? Did you get out to stretch your legs or were you just flat out done?
I've done a little running, but really I don't think I've run more than an hour at a stretch, but I've been trying to go faster in that hour. So really painful, like 45 minutes to an hour instead of quite an easy 3 or 4.
Okay.
And I did this funny thing, which you may have seen on that television thing over there. Have you seen the Insanity workout?
I've seen versions of Insanity.
I've seen the commercial. That's we usually I go to bed before those commercials come on.
Scott follows his son with his sleep patterns.
Well, just to go with it, other workout programs do exist, just to keep this equal. But for those that don't know, it's a short, sharp 45-minute bodyweight program that you do every day. And I tell you what, if you're not running, if you did a bit of that over winter, I think that would be a huge benefit to anyone's running, just because of what it'll do for your core strength, your mobility, your hamstrings, your quads, all of that sort of stuff. It's really quite good. So that I think the refocusing, really like hardly running at all, doing a bit of other stuff, and dare I say it, even drinking a bit and eating too much in between. I'm quite looking forward to this little run on Sunday now. But if you'd have asked me in September, I would rather have stuck needles in my legs than gone running again.
Not that I've ever, you know, I've battled with having a wristband on and having it cut. I mean, I've even tried to convince people around me that this is what I should do. Did you have any regrets as soon as that scissors clamped together and that that band was no longer, you know, intact?
None whatsoever. That was the nicest bit about it. And I was so happy that this was exactly what I wanted to do. The phrase that had been going through my head for too many hours, and we've all been there. We've gone through the dark times. You know, you push through them. There's something on the other side. But this just felt different, and I'd purposely gone through the night to see the sunrise because I know what a lift you get from that. And the phrase that kept going through my head was death march. I am on a death march. And that is not a moment when you're enjoying yourself, but it was a difference between that kind of, oh, I'm out of motivation, I need to just push through. It was just not as really happy. I was like, no, this is not what I want to be doing today. But what a weird time to find it out right in the middle of the biggest race that have motivated you back to health and fitness over 2 years.
Did you have a pacer with you at the time?
No. This is no pacers in the UTMB.
Well, nice to show my ignorance on that.
Do you think, well, you guys have a lot more pacering and pacing experience than I do. So do you think a pacer would have altered that moment? How does that run when you've got not just a sort of a voice in your head, but a genuine voice on your shoulder?
I, you know, in my opinion, I think it just gives you a broader range of options.
So
I mean, if you're talking to yourself, you know, you have the proverbial, you know, devil on one shoulder, angel on the other, saying the pros and cons, and you may talk yourself into something that a pacer may be able to, from a different perspective, see how you're doing and say, you know what, you're just going through a rough patch here. Let's go to the next aid station. I think we're okay. You're not in jeopardy of hurting yourself, or the opposite, where the pacer is saying, "Hey, listen, you have no idea what I see, and I think it's probably a good thing for you to cut out."
You have no idea what you're doing.
Yeah.
Clearly, I had no idea what I was doing.
You look worse than you feel. Believe me, you look awful. It's time for you to bag this one.
When someone says that, you really know you're in trouble. Because have you ever found that 9 times out of 10, if you were to get someone to take a picture of you when you feel like you can't possibly take another step, and if you look back at that picture a week later, you pretty much look fine.
Yeah. That's a real surprise when you say, "I was feeling so low at that point." And you have a smile on your face because, well, there's a camera, somebody said something, and you go, "You know what? I don't think I've looked better than that in many pictures where I've been feeling okay."
You know, Warren, with the cross training, the insanity cross training program that you were doing when you weren't running, do you feel that when you started getting back and training for this race this weekend, do you feel like you were still in good shape or possibly better shape? Do you think that helped?
I think the rest was definitely good for my body. And, you know, you get used to being worn out, and everyone balances it differently. It'd be interesting to see how Jason makes of all of this, because it sounds like from what I've read in the book, I don't know much about him otherwise, but he's clearly done an awful lot of miles. And that, his routine obviously suits his body. And I felt after 6-7 years of this, I've really enjoyed that break. Am I fitter? I doubt it. I can't honestly, hand on heart, say I've got the mileage in the bank for this weekend. But in terms of flexibility, movement, absolutely no aches and pains anywhere, I feel really good. So it's a really nice way to go into what is it's a fun race. It's organized by a brewery, quite literally. So the finish bag should be worth it, if nothing else.
Why, you know, have you ever wondered why more breweries or beer companies don't sponsor ultra events?
Well, they're drunk.
Because they make a lot of money off of our community, don't they?
I believe there's a high level of participation, and I think they should acknowledge that and join in.
Yeah, they have money bags.
Isn't there a running beer out there, or an electrolyte beer or something that I'm sure I've seen?
Warren, you just unveiled our new product line. That's a great idea.
Well, there is some light running beer for after races. I'm sure of it.
No, are you kidding me?
But you know, I think we've broken down the merits, even with the brew, even with Sunny Blende, our trail nutritionist. We've talked about carbo loading afterwards, the light carbonation that can help an unsettled stomach. We've talked about pain relieving aspects. I mean, just it comes down to it. There may be some real attributes to that being in your cruise. Quiver. What, not quiver? What is it? A quill. Is that what it is, Scott?
I don't know.
You help me with that. You know, when you put your arrow in a quill, right?
A quill?
So, yeah.
No, it's a quiver.
Is it a quilt?
It's a quilt. Ask the literary guy on the other end of the
phone. Yeah. Shakespeare, what is it?
I think it's ye olde quill, quiver, quilt. I have no idea. I'm going to go with quiver. I think quiver sounds good.
Good. Hey, Warren, since we're just casually talking, has that app Trivia Crack entered your world yet?
Trivia Crack? It sounds that intriguing. I'm sure I would know if it hasn't. Is it trivia about crack?
No, but there may be a question or two on that. It's an app that allows you to actively play others in a trivia contest, and I just would like to forewarn you, just avoid it at all cost if possible. it's one that will occupy.
Have you been playing it, Don?
Yeah, have you?
My daughter got me stuck on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, not it's, good.
No, it's not good.
Yeah. And so I'll send it over to you, Warren.
That has nothing to do with trail running. I don't know. Hey, so I'm interested, Warren. You are quite the world traveler, and you're back home. Where have you been since we've last talked to you? What countries and continents have you explored?
Well, do you know what? I don't think I've been quite as far in the last few months as usual. It's mainly been Spain, France, and Italy with a little bit of the UK. I mean, I went to Wales, but I don't know if that really counts. So Spain, France, and Italy mainly. It's all been fairly local, which, you know, really, it sounds like I've been to other countries, and clearly I have. But in American distance terms, it's a bit like driving to the shops for some milk. You know, we're talking a two-hour flight, and you're there. So, no, a bit of traveling around there. But I tell you what, and this may feel free to curtail this one if it turns out to be a bit random for the podcast. But if someone from the UK was looking to come to America and spend 3 months driving all over your entire country in a motorhome, any ideas what that sort of might be like? Because I'm looking at it at the moment, and the paperwork looks onerous. They don't seem to like drivers from the UK. They think we're going to crash immediately because we're not used to being on your side of the road.
That's what I was going
to
say. Well, you drive on the wrong side.
Well, that's true. We don't like drivers from the UK. That's very clear. In fact, it's on our driving test. How to identify a UK driver.
Are you looking for recommendations of where to drive?
Well, I think I'm looking for I'm plotting an adventure. The details will become clear in due course. But you may be unlucky enough to see both Erica and myself again this year, because we're looking to do a 3 month tour all over the entire country. Maybe not every last square inch of it, but certainly all of the running and trail running parts of it. And to get lost by motorhome, because that seems to give us a few more options. I mean, maybe Jason would know something about this, but I just don't know what the technicalities are. It looks awkward with the UK license and the no US residency to make this sort of thing happen without paying about $20,000 in rental fees.
Wow.
It would be cheaper to purchase a motorhome and sell it when you're done.
I have a friend that did that he bought a used motorhome and traveled with his family for, I think it was four weeks. And then got back and he sold it, and it, you know, took a little bit of a hit, but it was cheaper to do that than it was to rent.
Wow.
And now is the time with fuel prices. My goodness. I mean, in parts of the country as low as $1.70. That's true.
Really?
And factual, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we're at $2.11 around here in California, and we usually have many, many taxes on top of the standard price for California reasons. It's a golden state, right. You know.
In terms of timing, I think this is going to be more like later in the year, July, August, September, October time. Is that does that throw up any particular flags? Like, oh my God, you don't want to drive across the country then, or is that a great time? Or is it going to be, presumably the weather's going to be that varied from one side to the other. It's not quite like driving around the UK.
Very predictable.
Yeah.
Perfect time.
Although October, you could come across a fluke winter storm in the Rocky Mountains Midwest area.
Yeah, but you'll have a roof on that motorhome. You'll be all right.
Well, as long as, you know, maybe we do the Grand Canyon again. And, if Don, you could bring the open-air tent, we'd be covered for anything.
You know, we would be happy to go, but I have to convince Janet to go because I told her I had Scott's secret and that indoor heater for our tent. And he promised me there was enough fuel in that, and it lasted for about 5 minutes, and then it went out, because I really was in.
You had extra cartridges, didn't you? Propane cartridges?
No, I just I figured, you know, I was set up, and so off we go, and I'm literally in summer camping gear with this, you know, heater, and I almost felt guilty having it. I almost felt like somehow
cheating,
joining our tents, Warren, so that you would have some of this heat, but as it worked out, we survived, and the next day was a great run.
Nonetheless, Janet was not happy.
It will
not happy, and she was very cold.
We slept in the car portion of the night.
She was smiling though the next day. It may have been through gritted teeth, but certainly in terms of her public demeanor, I'm not saying it was always the same when she was out of our sight, but her public demeanor was sunlight itself.
I think the smile was because she had just contacted her attorney, and she knew
she was smiling because of the retribution she was going to enact on Don.
I'm certain of that.
She had negotiated a good settlement. Now, it has been a while since we spoke, and we've missed the odd email here and there. But come on, what have I missed in the world of Scott and Don? What's been going on there? Don't go through once now. One at a time, please. Come on.
Oh, I know.
Cheers.
we're about to launch the new TRN webpage with the ninjas. Ooh. Put it together, and very excited about that. Scott is just, he just gifted me this amazing poster that came from a something that Tim had created. You know that image of the, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's on the Facebook in different places, where the left half of the image has a gentleman exiting a door in a suit, and the right side, a runner launching onto a trail, and it just says, you know, some of us relax differently. And on the right-hand side, it says Saturday. So Friday, Saturday, then contrast. And it's just such a cool picture. And he surprised that yesterday as he brought it in. And it's now part of the TRN studio as we have it displayed.
I look forward to seeing that on the on Facebook or on the site, if it isn't already there.
It's on Facebook, and a lot of likes. And people said, how do I get that for the office? So Scott, or their office, or their personal domain. And so Scott is working on trying to figure out a way to produce them in a cost that we can all afford them and have them.
Yeah, we could definitely produce them, but the challenge is trying to do it so it makes sense financially.
Yeah, yeah.
No one wants to pay $50 or $60 for eight and a half by 11 glossy.
Now, if that's what you paid, Scott, I think it was well worth it. I enjoy it. It's fantastic. Thank you very much.
Now, when I was in Italy, the capital of fashion, in Milan there, everyone is obviously always dolled up to the nines, but I was surprised I didn't see the launch of the new Trail Runner collection on any of the catwalks while I was there. Was that an intention? Are you holding back on the Milan launch, or is the scene just not ready for this yet?
That was the reason we sent you a gift pack, was you were supposed to be the model on the runway.
They wouldn't.
Did you not get the memo?
There's an underground fashion scene going on, and we're part of that underground.
There's some great design on there. Everyone looks at that sweatshirt and says, what did you spill on yourself? Because the way the mud splat goes across the zip really confuses everybody.
You know, I've had that just yesterday. I was wearing one of the hoodies, and someone said, hey, you have stuff on your sweatshirt. And I go, yeah, it's supposed to be there.
you wouldn't get it. It's a trail running thing.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. So should we... Should we bring Jason on?
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Scott War.
I'm Sally McRae.
I'm Warren Pohl.
And Warren is going to make our introduction, right?
And we have with us, all the way from just outside of San Diego, in a slightly undisclosed location, the author of the seminal trail running tome, Never Wipe Your Ass with a Squirrel. That's the English version. The American version, Never Wipe Your Ass with a Squirrel. It's a trail and ultramarathon guide for weird folks. It's written by Jason Robillard, who appears to have done all of his research the hard way. He's done the miles, he's done everything else, and he's here with some big white headphones on that he says are his daughter's. So, Jason, where does that come from?
I'm sorry, what was that, Warren? The headphones apparently aren't working as planned.
Where do you begin with a book like that? You've got 127 pages I'm looking at here, and it covers just about every angle you can think of on trail running, and a lot that I don't think any of us could think of if we spent a lot of time thinking about it. Where do you begin with a book like this?
That's a good question. It started off, when I started ultra running, am really big on researching and trying to find out as much information as I possibly can. And when I started in ultras, I read everything I possibly could, then actually started running races and realized there were a lot of little topics that nobody really talks about. And my goal for the book was to give somebody who's just starting out in ultras sort of a behind the scenes look at all of the things that they're going to encounter along the way, including things that aren't really discussed in mainstream ultra running sources.
How did you get into ultra running, and how long have you been doing this crazy sport?
I started probably back in around 2006. My wife and I were at a Super Bowl party with some friends. You know, we're drinking and stuff. Actually, it was the Janet Jackson Super Bowl.
Oh, so yeah.
Was
that? Yes.
2005, 2006. And we had a friend that was running a 25K. And my wife and I weren't runners at the time. We ran a few miles just out of fitness, but we didn't run races and stuff. And we were amazed that somebody was going to run that long of a distance. And we got talking about running, and he brought up marathoners. And at the time, a marathon just seemed like a ridiculous distance. I mean, 26.2 miles, who the hell does that? You just assume that it requires some genetic gift. So we're drinking and stuff and talking about marathons. And, you know, after halftime, we're all pretty drunk. And the friend who brought up that was doing the running pulled me aside. And he's like, you know, there's races longer than marathons. And I was like, what? No way. He's like, yeah, they're called ultra marathons. They run on trails out in the woods. Like, these weirdo people run it. He goes, yeah, this race is like 50 miles long. I was like, 50 miles? How the hell is somebody going to run 50 miles? It boggled my mind. He's like, yeah, it really is. I thought he was lying. I was like, okay, there's no way a human can run that far. So being the curious person I am, I went home that night, got on my computer and Googled it. Sure enough, you know, the ultra marathons, it was really a thing. And I was shocked to find out that they were even longer than 50 miles. And I was captivated. I like doing really stupid stuff. And that seemed like a really stupid thing to do.
And in the drunken stupor, you signed up for a 50 miler, right?
I did.
That's usually how it all starts.
Yep.
In the middle of the night, it was literally like 4 a.m. And I had to work the next day, which was kind of an unfortunate thing. But I came across a race that wasn't too far away from my house. And so I, at the time, they didn't have an online application. So I printed out their form, filled it out, and put it in an envelope. And the next morning when I woke up, or when my wife woke up, actually, I didn't sleep that night. I told my wife, hey, do you care if I run this race? She's like, a race? Okay, I suppose that's fine. It's like, okay, it's like an hour and a half away. Is that going to be a problem? She's like, well, no, that'll be okay. It's 50 miles long. And she was just stupefied. She was like, what the hell is wrong with you?
Jason.
She was a part of the conversation before.
Jason, let me ask you, how do you discount all of a sudden you go from a marathon needs some type of genetic gift to discounting that distance altogether, stepping over it and into the 50-mile race?
In my research that night, I came across some of the people that did it. And this is going to sound horrible, but one of the things that motivated me or made me realize that, okay, maybe this is something that is accessible to the general population. I saw a picture of ultra runners running a race, and it was like a back of the pack kind of picture.
Right. Yeah. Like tutus and
huge backpacks. Yeah. I mean, these people were loaded down in gear. One guy was like obese. I was like, how is that even possible? And that was unfortunately the thing that made me realize that I could probably do this also.
Now, did you use the technique prescribed in your book for entering your first ultra, whereby you lock yourself in what sounds like a cabin in the woods with an internet connection, an antagonist, which I think perhaps you can explain, and some hard liquor? Did you adopt that approach? And if not, why? And how exactly did you devise that approach as a best way for a new runner to make sure they make that leap?
Well, initially, not really. By the time I actually printed out the form, filled it out, and, you know, put the check in there, I was pretty sober. But for all the subsequent races that I ran, they all pretty much went the same way. Get drunk with friends and start, you know, just trash talking each other. Like, hey, I bet I'll run this race if you run it. Okay, that's great. But actually, in the book, the technique that I used was the technique that I used to get my wife to sign up for her first ultra. Get her drunk and then antagonize her.
That works for a lot of things.
Yeah, it does. It's a good strategy.
So what was your experience on this first 50 miler? That's what I'm curious about.
It was absolute hell. Actually, I should backtrack a little bit. When I decided to sign up for the race, this was in Super Bowl, so it was January. The race was in September. And at that point, I had an endurance base that consisted of probably about a mile and a half. In my head, I looked at the calendar and drew up like a rough training plan. And by increasing it, you know, a certain number of miles per week, I could get up to doing 50 mile training runs. You know, that's obviously absurd, but with no experience at all, it seemed like a pretty good plan. And when I tried training for the ultra, that's when I ran into the realization that, you know, it takes a little bit more to do this than just putting in the miles. There's a lot of things that you have to learn. So anyway, long story short, the first race I ran ended up being a trail marathon. When I had signed up for the 50 miler, I dropped down to a marathon option for the same race. So I didn't actually run a 50 miler until the second year that I started training for it.
Well, that's I think that was probably a wise choice. And as I read the book in the introduction, you've done something I think that we all wish we could do at some point, and that is you decide not to quit your job, both you and your wife, get an RV and run around the country. Can you tell us a little bit about where does that fit in the timeline of this 50-mile run, and how do you swing this with kids too?
It started after I ran a few ultras, or I started training for ultras. I realized that my training plan was really bad. I ran into a lot of injuries, which now I could look back and say they were just overuse injuries. I didn't have enough base for the training volume I was trying to do. But in my impatience, I did some research and stumbled on the idea of barefoot running. And this was prior to Born to Run and all the hoopla, where barefoot running became like popular for a while. So just one thing led to another. I started doing some barefoot running, and I started blogging about it as part of an assignment for a grad class. And when Born to Run was published and it became, you know, barefoot running became a thing, I had one of maybe three websites on the entire web that actually described how to run barefoot. And that led to me writing a book about barefoot running, which led to Merrill, the outdoor company, eventually sponsoring my wife and I to travel around the country holding running clinics. So we spent 2 years driving around, basically living the life of professional runners, even though we're kind of really mediocre runners. It funded all of our travels.
Oh, that's a great story. That's great.
It was really awesome. In the U.S., we have just a phenomenal trail system all over the country. You know, we have some incredible mountain ranges. There's just literally tens or hundreds of thousands of miles of trails out there, and we got a chance to explore a lot of them.
Warren is thinking something similar. Warren, why don't you tell us a little bit about your thoughts and pick Jason's brain here?
Well, I'd be interested to have a chat with you, Jason, about that whole RV, get lost, go trail running all over the States. It's a project I'm trying to put together for later this year. But one of the bits that really stood out for me in your book, and I'm guessing this is a lot of it's hard-earned experience, there's either you've run in some really remote places or you were in the special forces, because... There's a big section here. Most of us might go, while I'm going trail running, I'll pack a bit of food, let everyone know where I'm going, and that'll be it, bit of water. But you've got techniques in the book for how to, like, trap rainwater, how to survive in a canyon for X amount of hours, the fact that you don't need to eat for weeks and weeks. There's a lot of detail on survival, and also, at one point, combat. What weapons did you take on the trail? Which techniques are best for disabling a bear or an assailant? And I know it is the Wild West out there, but that's some serious preparation. And would you recommend that for someone looking to go out and explore?
If your trail running consists of, you know, going out to the local urban trail system, you know, and running around a city park where there's people pushing baby strollers, you probably don't need a lot of survival training. But in our travels, we would go on some trails all over. Pretty much the whole Western U.S. is filled with trails that are ridiculously remote. And once I started running some of those trails, I realized as trail runners, we're putting ourselves in really dangerous positions on a regular basis. You know, you might – here's an example. My wife Shelly and I were running outside of Netherlands, Colorado, yep, up in the mountains. And we were on a trail that was about – the trailhead itself was about 10 miles from any town. And we were running about 10 miles – it was a 10-mile trail one way. We ran about half of the trail. And right after the turnaround point, she fell. Like, she took a huge header into some rocks and had like horrific cuts and bruises, and probably came about 2 inches from hitting her head on what was just like a really sharp rock. And it was a realization that had she actually hurt herself to the point where she couldn't get out on her own, we were kind of screwed. It would have taken hours to be able to get her out of there, or even probably 2 hours before I could get to any sort of help. So that was part of the reason why I wanted to present a lot of the survival stuff, a lot of emergency stuff in the book, because I think it's good skills for ultra runners to have.
You know, I want to get back to the whole idea of how you, in the book, in the very beginning, you define what a trail is. And specifically, you have the Christian Peterson test. Can you explain who that is and what that test is?
Yeah, Christian Peterson is a good friend of mine who also runs ultras. Actually, he's right now doing strongman competitions and trying to train for ultras. He's a huge dude. Early on in our barefoot running days, he was also a barefoot blogger. He would talk about going out for a trail run. And he always talked about running trails like he was some kind of badass trail runner. And then he posted a picture of it, and it was literally a crushed limestone path through his suburban town. I mean, it wasn't even like this isn't a trail. There's not even any rocks or leaves or anything. It looks like it's manicured. It's like the city maintenance department comes through and rakes it every day. So I realized that there was a discrepancy in what people consider to be trails. And not to diminish people that run on crushed limestone trails, but that takes an entirely different skill set than running on a remote mountain trail in the Rockies or a root-covered, leaf-covered trail in the Appalachians or something like that. So I think it's important to define exactly what kind of trail you're talking about.
I think I read in your book, if you can push a stroller on it, it's not a trail.
Yeah, that's my general description of a trail. Having said that, I have a friend, Andy, who lives in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, runs the Marquette 50-miler race. When we lived in the same town and go on occasional trail runs, he would actually take his daughter in a jogging stroller on just ridiculously technical trails. He'd be like lifting the stroller over stumps and stuff like that and pushing her through.
That stroller have a seatbelt in it?
Presumably it did. His little daughter would be bouncing around in there like a bobblehead doll. That's a pretty good descriptor I use of what would be considered a technical trail and what would just be like a trail that isn't a road.
You know, I like in the book, this is, and I think Warren and Don and I were talking a little bit before this, and, you know, just kind of a simple explanation of the book that, you know, if you have never run a trail or if you've never run an ultra, you can pick this book up and it's kind of a how-to book. Not unlike, you know, Hal Kerner's book that he released not too long ago, but this is, it's very basic. So you can pick it up and learn the basics of trail running, especially you have a section in here on trail etiquette. And I think that's one thing that, that most trail runners, it's almost like the first time you go golfing, the first time I went golfing, or first 10 times I went golfing, I was unaware of the etiquette. There's no sign that says you can't walk across someone's line on the putting green, you know, or, you know, that's just not something that's said. It's something that's learned. And I like that, you know, you spell it out very in black and white. You know, here are the basic premises of trail etiquette.
Scott, there are some things that are basic and some things that you might not expect to be basic, like on page 72, running naked. Jason, you're not going to get a pass on that. This is a Trail Runner Nation podcast, and we want to know about naked.
He's barefoot, and he's thinking, "Hey, that works."
Yeah,
let's take the next step.
Running naked, we'd like to move on to pooping chapter.
So the running naked bit actually came about from barefoot running.
Told you.
Weirdly enough. So for a number of years, I was part of a Runner's World barefoot running forum. I got to become good friends with all the people that participated in that. And we would have endless discussions on running form. How do you perfect your running form? Mm. And we came up, actually a friend of mine, Kate Kift, who's also a trail runner, came up with an idea that we knew that if you limited the vertical movements of your body, you could run smoother.
True.
So she came up with the idea that a female could judge their running gait, the efficiency of their running gait, by boob wobble. So depending on how much their boobs bounce.
Really?
And the goal
Sally, we need you to weigh in on this when he's done.
Crazy, right?
Well, I guess it depends on the woman. And yes, how endowed she is.
It does. And Kate was qualified to talk on this matter. So
the BW, the boob wobble. You know, the new Garmin watch has a vertical oscillation. So they've just put a different term on it.
They've made it a technical term. And, but it's really boob wobble.
And you know what? I thought it was the top of the head they were somehow measuring with GPS, but that strap that goes around your chest, they are essentially just measuring the bounce of the boob.
Hey, that goes for men too.
Yeah, and it does, depending on how fit you are.
Yes.
I'm offended by that, Sally.
Sally may be referring below the waist as well. I'm not sure. We have a wobble that can happen anywhere.
Well, and that's what led to the running naked thing. So as runners, we follow stupid fads. And one of the fads at the time that my friends and I were following was running in a kilt. And naturally, if you're wearing a kilt, you don't wear anything under the kilt. And we noticed after a few runs that the boob wobble concept also pertained to guys' junk wobble, if you will.
The old JW.
Yeah. So that led to a discussion, multiple discussions about running naked and the actual utilitarian value of running naked. And it occurred to me that not a lot of people trail run naked. As such, that's probably a good topic to talk about in the book. By the way, if you guys haven't ever run naked on trails, it's pretty awesome. I would highly recommend it. Check with your local, you know.
Okay, little side note, round table right now. I want to know from each of you if you've ever done it. Oh. So evidently Jason has. Uh-oh. Sally?
Yeah. Absolutely not, and zero desire to. I can't even believe this is a topic.
You can't believe it's a topic. Of course it's a topic.
The challenge, the gauntlet has been thrown down, Sally.
Oh, man, this is so uncomfortable. And the chance of, like, you know, that slight chance, and for some of us, a big chance of tripping and falling or, you know, running into poison oak. Oh, my gosh. No, thank you. I don't want it in those places.
You don't want to get hurt on the trail and have to wait for somebody to come rescue you and have to explain. I was just trying to work on my boob wobble.
Yeah. That's the time that you hit your head like your wife was going to do, and you really are wandering around a bit dizzy without clothes on. Not good.
Warren, it's wrong. People, it's wrong. It's not okay.
Warren, would it be okay in Britain to do that? What is it, the policy over there? What is the queen? What does the queen say?
The queen is she's the sort of key boob wobble monitor in the UK. It's a little known fact. I don't think I get taken to the tower and get my head chopped off for that. But if we do, please delete this at some point. No, I think that's fine. We love a bit of nudity in the UK. You only have to look at our cinema going back from the 50s or so, and a lot of cheeky, saucy seaside postcards and nudity going on. So we play prim and proper on the outside and down and dirty on the inside.
You're
so
you're avoiding the question.
Have I ever naked trail run?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. But I wouldn't rule that out. There was a naked cyclist.
Disappointing. So disappointing.
No, I'm sorry.
What's
the
desire? Why would you ever want to do that?
Jason just told us, man. He said it's awesome. We're gonna have to talk to
you. Not. It's just a life experience that clearly four out of five of us here have completely overlooked.
Jason, you need to give us your sales pitch on this. You say it's great. Tell us the reasons why.
Aesthetics.
Jason looks like he's in shape. So.
Trail runners tend to be pretty fit individuals, and what's better than seeing a bunch of naked fit individuals running around in the woods? No, it's a freeing experience. Obviously, I have a fondness for nudity, and I'm not really a bashful person, so it fits my personality well. And I guess on a philosophical level, for trail running, it strips away a lot of, I don't know, it just feels like a more pure experience. Now, having said that, I don't normally trail run naked all the time. Very limited. It has to be a very remote area or a specific naked trail run type race or something like that. It's not, going to go out on the local trails.
Are there actually sign up, get naked trail runs?
I was just going to say, did you just say
there race? Are? There are.
Wow. Is this only known like in the naked community? never heard of him.
I will tell Jason, I'll tell you, that is a race that you want to make sure you don't fold your bib up. You want to go ahead and keep it full size.
you really have to be careful. What's that? I'm sorry?
You put a number on. Where do the safety pins go? Are we going with like skin marking here? There's so many questions. I don't know where to begin. And feet. Are you wearing a shoe? Are you wearing some shoes? Or is this a really full naked, no shoes affair?
Most people wear shoes. As much as I've tried to convince the naked running community to try running barefoot, barefoot running on trails is rarely a good idea, especially if you're going longer distances, especially in the dark with very little light, which is usually where the naked races tend to be.
you're speaking as if this is real. Is there a subculture of naked runners out there that I'm unaware of?
It's a very small group, I found. However, a lot of trail runners in the right environments can be persuaded to run naked. I'll put in a plug for one of my favorite races, the Woodstock Trail Running Festival in Michigan, which was the site of my first 100-mile finish. But they have multiple naked races as part of the weekend trail running festival. So most of my group trail running naked experiences have come at that event.
I imagine if you want to see a group with just pristine gait, I mean very little bouncing, then you would go to the naked trail running group. I bet you collectively there's a real study there for the gait purists.
Well, it is. For the people that study gait, I mean, trail runners are... I think the best example of running gait. We need good running gait to be able to navigate trails. We can't use the ridiculous overstriding that roadrunners use. Therefore, there's not a lot of bouncing and wiggling in trail runners typically. So, yeah, I mean, I would support funding a study that studied naked trail runners.
Awesome. Sally, I think you have the next topic because where do you go from naked running but pooping? So
pooping.
What was your thought?
Clothes are already gone, so your book, the list, it made me laugh. The list of what to do when you poop, how to go about it, how to be efficient, how to dig a hole. you know, what if you're in a race and there, you know, it's one of those courses where there's not a lot of trees, not a lot of places to go and hide, and you don't have time to maybe dig a hole, or you don't even have any toilet paper. Talk to us a little bit about that. I mean, you have it listed here, some things that you can do, and obviously the title of your book kind of highlights this chapter. So
my entire take on running in general, as far as training, is all of your training should be very specific in that you're training for what you're going to encounter during a race, which includes pooping.
Yeah.
And I find a lot of people just sort of neglect that and, you know, expect to, if it happens during the race, it happens, and I'll just kind of deal with it there. But, you know, pooping during a race is a pretty big deal. There's a lot of logistical issues that have to be worked out, including, you know, where do you poop? What happens when you don't have wiping material? Most of us don't carry a lot of toilet paper with us. So what are some alternatives? What kind of environment are you in? You know, pooping in a trail in New England is going to be different than pooping on a trail in Arizona, you know, in the desert. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with that? And that's one of the things that I wanted to cover in the book, just bringing up ideas for people to think about as they're planning out their training.
Scott? Okay, so we haven't talked about how to get this book, but, and we will put a link on how you can get this book, because you have to get this book. Whether you're a beginner or whether you're
a veteran,
seasoned, you have got to get this book. There's some bullet points in what happened?
I don't know. Keep on rolling, Scott.
Anyway, there are some bullet points in this chapter on pooping that are freaking hilarious and practical. First of all, there's a photo, not a naked photo, but people simulating the correct stance, which I think is very helpful for those who have never pooped in the woods. But there are certain bullet points I think are funny. So,
well, list them out, Scott.
Right after,
I'm leaning forward.
Right after drop the deuce,
yeah,
is don't stand up right away. It will clench your cheeks together, which will increase the wiping.
There is a vital technical tip. And you know, who would not thank Jason for knowing that beforehand? Because the rest of us have to learn it the hard way around.
Yeah, we all did.
Well, what is the prescribed time, Jason? How long should one maintain that position after drop? After the drop?
After the drop of the deuce?
Yeah.
Well, it really depends on the nature of the deuce, you know? I mean, the evening before, did you eat a lot of cheese? Did you eat, you know, an extra large burrito? So there's a lot of variables at play. But generally speaking, you just want to stay in the position long enough to be able to wipe before standing up. And be aware of what you have for wiping material. If you have paper, you know, you can give yourself a little bit of freedom there. You know, you could stand up, maybe, I don't know why you'd want to walk around at that point before wiping, but you could do it. But if you only have like a little chunk of moss or like a pine cone or something.
A pine cone.
Wow.
Which is really actually pretty effective if you go in the right direction. But if that's all you have, you really have to maximize the potential of that wiping material. Otherwise, you end up with a really unfortunate situation where you have remnants chafe.
That's a good point.
For those of you listening to this right now while on your long run and you just took a shot of goo, I'm sorry. I apologize.
It's your topic, Sally.
Yeah, you brought it up.
Any other bullet points?
Sally, for those who aren't watching at the moment, don't forget this in business. Sally is apparently eating, lunch, breakfast, dinner while it's this conversation.
I am. I just took the mahi out of the oven. I'm trying to fuel here. It's a bit difficult, but, you know, I'm just thinking fuel, not food.
It looks good. And really, we're sort of just squaring the circle, aren't we? It goes in one end, it comes out the other. We've got all the whole lot going on here.
You know, there is another point on here that I think is worth mentioning.
A bullet point?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And that is actually prior to the deuce dropping.
Right.
Is when you're pulling down your pants, make sure they clear the path that the poo will take from the butt to the ground.
That's a mistake you only make once.
It, and I'm sure all of us have. I know I've been there.
You have to do a little projecting. You have to, you know, take, there's some geometry in this activity. Jason,
people, this is why you need to be doing your squats. Okay. Get those quads nice and strong, strong butt, strong legs.
I'll mention an additional bullet point that is not in the book that I learned from my running partner when I first started running. He coined the term, and Don, you'll know what it is, the clean launch. You need to make sure that you get a clean launch.
The coveted clean launch. When you get one of those babies, you know that everything is going right for
you. It's going to be a great day.
So let's collectively talk a little bit about, you know, the dynamics of this not the clean launch, but just the activity. It's different at mile 5 than it is at mile 50. When your legs start to shake and can't hold you, you're in a different world.
One of the things is your inhibition has definitely changed, right?
Oh,
you know, you're nervous the first 10 miles, but you know when you're at mile 50 or 60 of 100, it doesn't matter who sees you or what they see, right?
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it really doesn't. And that's one of the things that drew me to ultras. Later on in the race, it strips away every aspect of humanity that we normally, you know, the facades that we put up of just whatever, get stripped away late in an ultra. You see shit out there that you're never going to see anywhere else, whether it be somebody breaking down and crying hysterically in the fetal position because they can't open their packet of goo, or you know, some dude dropping a deuce 6 inches off the trail as you run by. It's like, whoa, hey, you had peanuts for lunch. That, you know, it's great.
when you run by that person and you go, good work, good job. Like they just climbed a hill. Good job, man.
good for you, buddy.
Yeah. Well done.
For this late in the race, that's an excellent squat form you have right there.
Very productive.
You clearly train well.
You've done your job. That was productive. Warren, go ahead.
Say, maybe you correct their squat form. You know, if you're feeling good, they can tell you, hey, your knees are just in front of your toes, back a little bit. You know?
What is the pacer's role in something like that? Does the pacer coach you? Do they give you some quad support? Or they just is it appropriate just to turn away and or walk forward? Or
how what are we still talking about this? There's like 100 chapters in this book.
This is your topic, Sally, and we are going to do it justice.
We are talking about the elephant in the room.
This is boys right here. You guys love talking about I said move on to how to get rid of that annoying training partner. It's not really a chapter.
It is.
This. I just came upon it just now and it's cracking me up. But we can still talk about poop and diarrhea and fading quad muscles at the end of the race.
Okay, closing thoughts on poop, and let's talk about getting rid of annoying training partners. So any closing comments or thoughts on poop?
Well, I think it's important. Oh, go ahead, Warren.
No, I was going to say I would go with Baden Powell, the founder of the Scout Movement. His logo or motto: "Be prepared." And if you're going long, same as Jason would advise on the bush knife and the emergency flares and the map and the proper preparation on that front, plus your form, plus everything else, a couple of wet wipes in a freezer bag and a little tube of hand gel will go a very long way if you happen to find yourself stuck somewhere.
Good point. Anybody else want to add to that? Are we ready to talk about annoying training partners?
I'm ready to talk about partners.
What compelled you, Jason, to take a chapter on annoying training? Did you have an annoying training partner?
Well, this is the deal.
What's his name?
When I wrote the book, I was contemplating whether or not to add it because, of course, every person I've ever run with reads that and they assume that I'm talking about them.
Especially if you're no longer running with them.
Yeah, exactly. I could easily count, you know, I've run with thousands of people over the years, and I could count on one hand the number of people that I've actually wanted to get away from. And in almost every case, it's people that I encountered during a race, and it's almost always because they were being really negative and they were dragging me down.
Yep. Yeah.
I love meeting new people and just talking about weird or stupid stuff. So it's really hard to annoy me.
I have a really high annoyance factor, except for kids, but that's another issue altogether. But as far as that, I had a lot of people that actually asked this question. Usually they were drunk at the time, but they would ask, you know, I'm running with somebody and I really don't like this person, but I don't know how to approach getting rid of them. And that's something that I've never read anywhere else. I had no idea. I've never come across that information anywhere. Therefore, it seemed like something good to put in the book.
You know, so
let's expand.
So there's three methods, and I want to talk about the first one. The first one is the most recommended, and that's the direct route.
And it's the one that no one will ever do.
No,
but it says you know, you just tell them, you know, you don't want to run with them anymore, or if you want to be
direct.
If you want to be more dramatic. Remember on our last run when you talked nonstop for 6 hours about how barefoot running changed your life? I spent the entire time contemplating the pros and cons of murder versus suicide.
And most people...
But you follow up, Jason, by saying this is probably the healthiest approach.
Yeah, there really is. You know, honesty, I'm a big fan of radical honesty, just putting yourself out there and being like, hey, this is where I'm coming from. All the cards are on the table. This is the way it should be. But I realize that most people prefer not to take that route.
Do you think it would be a healthier world if we all took that route? I don't want to get too distracted from the important topic of how do you shed this annoying trail running partner.
Are we going into relationship advice here?
Funny you should mention that.
Where is that to go?
Jason has more to the story. Go ahead, Jason.
Yes.
That's actually, so my background, I was a psychology teacher, high school psychology teacher for years. But before that, I was trained, my undergraduate degree is in experimental psychology. I was going to be a sex and relationship researcher.
Oh, we need another podcast.
Yeah, I know. It's entirely off topic. But I actually wrote a book. My latest book is about relationships. And a big part of that is based on the premise that we're just not very honest in any of our relationships, whether they be romantic relationships or relationships with friends or family or acquaintances. We don't tell the truth very often. And if we did, it would make things a lot better. And I think training partners, if you have an annoying training partner that you really can't stand running with, the best approach is just to be like, hey, I don't like running with you.
Hence the naked running. This is where the naked running makes sense then.
Yeah, a little bit.
Very direct.
In your face, if you will.
Yeah, exactly.
But there is beyond this. There's another point in the we've done the ethical and the moral way to drop that training partner. But if I remember rightly, there is another one, which is where you start becoming less engaged, shall we say. I'm going to turn up late 3 weeks in a row. I'm going to run at a pace you don't like. I'm going to talk about topics you don't want to talk about. Maybe we could look into that one a little bit as well. For those who aren't quite ready for the honesty yet.
Method two, be passive aggressive.
Yeah, and I really don't like passive aggressiveness, but it for many people, it's a preferable route than honesty. And I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can be passive aggressive with, you know, running, just out annoy the annoying person. That usually works pretty well. Most people have those hot button things that just drive them crazy. And it's not too hard to find that kind of thing.
I think that Don has a passage he'd like to read. This is method three.
why are you throwing this to me,
Scott? I just think it's funny.
Out-annoy them. The idea is to escalate every annoying thing they say. For example, if you say, I'm a Republican, and I believe we should have guns, you respond with, damn right, we should have guns. How else are we going to launch the revolution? In fact, we're having a meeting tomorrow night, and you're just the kind of person we're looking for. By the way, what's your blood type?
Most people that have crazy ideas will have a limit to how far they're willing to take that craziness. And if you're willing to go even farther, that's another excellent way to get rid of annoying training partners. which coincidentally, if you're in a relationship and you want to get out of the relationship, it's also a pretty decent way to get out of relationships if you don't want to take the honest approach.
It's so important to find someone that you can run with, that meets not only your personal schedule, but your personality and your pace. There's a lot of things that need to coincide and align themselves so that you find that running partner. Not an easy task.
So what about if we were to pool our resources here, top three qualities in the ideal trail running partner?
Ooh. Someone that's an optimist.
Running with just punctuality. Doesn't, you know, whatever time you've agreed to be there, they need to be there as well, as do you. I think that's the basis on which the whole thing starts or fails.
True. You know, Lee McKinley, who I've run with for a long time, he always told me about the 10-minute rule. And I thought, and what I understood it was, if you're not here within 10 minutes of the time we start, that means we're leaving. But as I look back, and he's always there on time, the 10-minute rule is show up 10 minutes before we start to run. I misunderstood the 10-minute rule.
You know, I think one of those qualities Jason already mentioned, which was annoying to him, and Don was about to bring it up, and that is just a positive attitude. I mean, there's those people out there, you know, whether it's trail running or in your life, that are always looking at the glass half full and negative Nellies. Sorry, Nelly, I didn't mean to pigeonhole you there. But I think that's one of the things. I want to run with somebody that makes me a better runner and a better person.
Agreed.
So where does that take us with pace? Because there can be times, I think, where, you know, if you have the same pace as someone, that's great, but you never quite push each other. So do you use different training partners who maybe you have the occasional ones who you know are way quicker than you and you're going to be playing catch up and that's really good? You know, what if you get faster than your training partner or they get faster than you? Does that stoke the competitive fire or does it bust the relationship? It's a delicate dynamic. It's a miracle that any of us managed to run with anyone for more than about 5 minutes.
I would agree with that. Finding training partners, really good training partners, is very difficult. In fact, my regular training partners, not surprisingly, also turned out to be my ideal pacers and crew for the ultra I ran, because we had a connection. As far as pace, that's always difficult. Most of my training partners, I had two training partners that I did a lot of my running with, Jesse Scott, Jeremiah Cataldo. Both of them were ultra runners that were significantly faster. And they're borderline elites, where I was like struggling between like back of the pack. And my big goal was to move up to the middle of the pack. So me running with them made me a much better runner because they were constantly pushing me. The effect that I had on them was basically run for 5 miles and then slow down enough where I could convince them to stop running and go get beer during the race. But it is important to find training partners that can do that. And I think flexibility and similarity as far as personality type really are important, because you have to be able to find somebody that you can have an 8-hour conversation with on a long run, which is really difficult to do. And I think you also need to have somebody who's flexible enough where they can understand the value of training harder or, you know, not quite as intense as what they might train if they were on their own. Because in ultras, you know, you could walk for 12 hours and it would still be decent training for races. You know, there's a lot of variability in what constitutes training when it comes to ultras and trail running in general.
Let's talk about that 8-hour training run. Do you notice how in the beginning there's so much to talk about, and you have like three or four different things that you want to say, and all of a sudden about mid training run or three quarters of the way through, there's not a lot of talking going on. There's, all of a sudden the ideas are a bit stymied. Sally, what do you look for in a training partner? We haven't heard for your contribution on this one.
Yeah, I think it's a great topic, especially because, you know, if you start to look at racing some of the longer distances where maybe you'd want a pacer, it's kind of good to find out who would be a good pacer while you're training. And I actually, Dave Daly and I, we climbed Mount Wilson yesterday. We had this exact conversation. We talked about just basically like ideal training partners, and he and I, we've been training a lot together, and we're both training for 100, and he's going to be pacing me again at Western States, and I'm going to be his crew chief for his 100 in August. And yesterday the route that we took, we climbed up like 7.5 miles, but he was like an hour behind me on the road. And I told him, I was like, you know what? My coach told me that I have to go really easy on climbs right now because I'm coming back from a hamstring injury. I said, so you can catch me. And he's been trying to get up to this point really fast. So once we got up to the peak, we then decided just to run down easy together. But as we ran down, we were talking about that. I said, you know, this is why I love training with you, because it isn't always about like we need to stay together and talk the whole time, and we have this understanding where we both have very specific training focuses, but it's just nice knowing that each other is out on the mountain. So knowing that he is, you know, 500 yards ahead of me is totally fine. Or just if we want to run down and talk together, Dave and I both love music. So sometimes we just want to listen to music and sometimes talk. So I think for me, training, going out and just training with Dave is so much easier than, you know, I have other friends that they want to stay together and talk the entire time. And that, you know, I can talk a lot too, but when it comes to like really specific training and what your run focus is, I think that you have to find the people that kind of fit that. But it also goes with when you look at your whole week, if you just want to go for a group run and, you know, it's an easy recovery day, it doesn't really matter what the pace, you can kind of just do whatever and meet some new people, that's great. But I think it's good to have like key people that can push you. Guys push me, and so I know that they're going to make me faster and tougher, and so I like to train with them. But also I think personality type, you know, as mentioned early, that's huge. And it's good to actually talk about that. Like, hey, what do you like to do and how do you like to train? And just so you know, this kind of works for me. I've had those conversations with all of the people that I train with the most.
Have you ever had a fire a training partner, Sally? And which method did you use?
where someone that was like really annoying or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I have not come across that yet. And I think for me, I'm at the point in my life where it is such a joy and a privilege to be able to run with people. But my training schedule is very specific every time I run. So I usually run by myself. So I don't run with a lot of people enough to get to that point. But I will tell you that I did like a training race back in October, and there was a guy on my tail that would not stop talking. And he was pretty annoying. I'll just come out and say it. And he was trying to be funny, but it was not funny at all. And he just kept on making these remarks. And I just completely stopped responding. And he finally then said something like, well, gosh, I guess I'm not that funny. Geez. And I didn't say anything at all. But I think he just finally got the hint. And then I would keep on trying to like get away with him, and he keep on catching me. But finally I just made a surge. I think it was on a downhill, and I was like, I am done. You are not, we're not staying together anymore. But usually if somebody comes up next to me and they start talking my ear off, like in a race like that, I will usually say, hey, you know what? I'm so sorry. Like, I'm not much of a talker when I race. I think that most people understand that, you know. And I've even had people respond like, oh man, I love talking on a race, man. I'm chatty Cathy during a race. I was like, oh man, I wish I could be that way. And it's just kind of, you know, try to be friendly about it as best you can. But if people are rude and inappropriate, then I'll just keep my mouth shut and I won't respond. That's kind of like my way of, I'm not impressed with what you're saying, so I'm not going to engage with you.
Hey, Sally, I really like the way that you mentioned that you and Dave are able to separate, you know, 500 yards or run together, that it's not a competition. My goodness, no. That training is not a place to measure yourself against another runner. It's a place to train and a place to relax, enjoy. And if it means it's hammer time and it's time to fly, then go. But it doesn't mean I'm raising the flag and let's race. It's do whatever you want to do and do what feels right. And I'll meet you at the bottom where we usually stop and gather ourselves back together and just enjoy the freedom and autonomy of doing what's right for you at the time. And a training partner, the right training partner, understands that and lets you do that. At least that's been my experience.
I, I think that's good too. You know, I have this conversation every now and then with people, because I know that in our sport too, I mean, Strava is a really big deal to some people. And, you know, and you get comments sometimes like, oh, I got the CR. I saw so-and-so is really fast. And it's like, come on, you know, we really need to communicate that every time you run should not be a race. It should not be about getting course records or how fast or beating this person. That's what races are for. And so, you know, Dave and I have always, you know, and most of the guys, I mean, all the guys on my crew that I train with, we communicate pretty well just in that understanding is like, we have our focus and you have your goals. And when you train, it's to work towards your goals, not to race. Your goal is to get to the race line so that you can do really well. And so, you know, it just makes the training that much more enjoyable when you communicate effectively, because then there's no stress. So if, you know, like last night, Dave and I were just, we watched the sunset and then we get this huge view of the LA city lights. And so we're descending, we have great conversation, but then it's a few minutes of just quiet, just enjoying the view, you know, and it's never awkward, or if he goes ahead or if I go ahead, and I think that's how it should be. You want to enjoy the process and be natural in how you, you know, and how you have that training partner relationship. So.
So Jason, one final question before we wrap this up. The title of the book is Never Wipe Your Ass with a Squirrel. Or arse.
Thank you, Warren.
So do you have experience with that? Have you, why that title?
What's the strangest thing you've ever used? Is that the question, Scott?
I would think that a furry squirrel would actually be quite preferable.
Enjoyable.
Yeah.
The title was actually comes from Pablo, the guy in the picture in the book who's squatting and demonstrating the squatting technique. We had a conversation about what's the weirdest thing you've ever used to wipe with. Because if you've trail run for a while, you've been in that situation where it's like, okay, well, I got to drop a deuce here, but I don't have anything with me to wipe. So what do you use? And I made some comment about using, you know, don't use woodland creatures. And then he's like, never wipe your ass with a squirrel. I had other friends, my friend Krista, who actually made t-shirts for Squirrel Wipe, the book, said, yeah, you don't want to use squirrels because they get really grabby, you know, and you don't want that down by your junk. But it's the strangest thing I've ever used is pretty conventional. I think it's like stones or pine cones or something like that in nature. Usually I'll carry wet wipes with me, but not always. So it doesn't, my experiences really don't get that crazy.
Well, Jason, if you're looking to find more about Jason, you can go. He has a website, jasonrobillard.com. There's many blogs that he is updating that he lists on this website, including there's a blog about this book. You can get the book, and Jason, which is the most preferable way? I notice you can buy it on Amazon as well as your other books. The how-to book of let me see if I can get the right name of it here. The Barefoot Running book is on there. The Trail Running, Ultimate Guide to Trail Running and Ultra Marathons is on there. Where would you like our audience to go to get the book? Does it matter?
Amazon is the best place. I believe right now the Never Wipe Your Ass with a Squirrel is only available on Amazon.
Okay.
About half of my books are. Some of them, like the Barefoot Running book and the Ultimate Guide to Trail Running, are probably available in bookstores. Mm-hmm. But Amazon is the best central place to get all of them.
And I recommend picking it up. There's another great chapter that you'll have to read after you get the book. It's about what to talk about, and you list if it's a new relationship, here are the topics, suggested topics to talk about if it's a new runner partner. If you've been out there for a certain period of time, kind of a mid period, then here are the topics. And if you've been around this person for a long time, we could have gone for a full podcast on those bullet points. So fantastic book. Warren, any closing comments from across the pond?
I just thoroughly enjoyed all of it. I thought it covered so many things. I had to work on the juice dropping bit, because clearly juice to us is something you drink, you know, J-U-I-C-E. I thought, why are these people dropping juice all over the woods? Is this some weird American trail running ritual I don't know about? But, you know, after I got my head around the spelling of that and a few other things, No, it's great. And lots of little gems, even just flicking back through now. Little things stuck out. How to read a course profile. And maybe there's probably a whole other topic in this, but I know how to read a course profile, but I somehow, my brain is unable to relate that course profile to reality. I can look at it and go, that looks pretty hard, or that'll be fine. And it never seems to bear any resemblance to what I then experience. And I'm pretty sure I'm on the same course, but I could be taking us down a whole other angle at the wrong time here. But it's a good one. I'd recommend it to a load of people. And it's really nice to be able to actually meet you, Jason.
Well, thanks, Warren. I appreciate that.
Sally, did you get all your questions answered on pooping, et cetera?
Yes, I've had my fill. I'm talking about poop. Thank you.
I'm glad I could help, Sally.
And you're Barefoot Jason on Twitter, right? Is that you?
I am, yes.
Okay, cool. I just added you. It was so fun to talk with you and hear about your book and read about your book. It's awesome. You're doing a great thing.
Well, thank you.
And Sally, you're a Yellow Runner on YouTube. Tell us about that, how we can keep up with your activity over there.
Yeah, I'm still Sally McCray on YouTube, but the show is Yellow. And I try to put out an episode every week. And my goal is just to make content that's helpful and hopefully beneficial just to the running community. And just, again, just another way to connect and create community. So, yeah.
Fantastic. I've enjoyed those episodes and have put a thumbs up like on those. Warren Pohl at warrenpohl.com, as he is a...
as ever. And if you're really unlucky in your country sometime this year, so get your excuses ready.
Fantastic.
I love it.
We'll definitely make sure we join you on a run or two as a Trail Runner Nation. Now go out and, wait, Scott, do we have anything else to say?
No.
That's it. We're done. Go out and run.
Mas.
All right, guys. Hey, right. Fun stuff.
Good. So fun.
Thanks, guys.
I miss you guys.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. A fun conversation, Jason. You fit right in. That was
okay.
Great,
Jason.
Jason.
I don't know. I wasn't gonna say this on the podcast, but I was looking at your.
I'm recording. Go ahead.
Your relationship book. The name of the book. I don't know if this was tongue in cheek or not. I read it thinking it was. The name of this book is The No Bone Zone, the ins and outs of curing long-term relationship boredom.
Wow.
Oh, I'm keeping that on the podcast because we want to boost your sales, Jason.
That's very clever with words, Jason. Very clever.
Yeah, this title was also my friend Tricia, who designed the cover, also helped me out with the title. I went through about 50 different ideas for the title, and she brought that up and is like, you know what? This really fits the theme of the book, and it takes that same approach of like self-experimentation, but not taking it too seriously that I used in Squirrel Wipe, and really applies that to, you know, our intimate relationships and how can we make our relationships better by just doing a few different things that are sort of outside the box. Mm-hmm.
Clearly the No Bone Zone was title number 50, because once you hit that, there's no reason to think of number 51. That is clearly the stopping point. Hey guys, thanks.
Thanks,
Warren.
Thanks, everybody, for joining.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey guys.
Cheers, guys.